Mark, it's the 87th Precinct podcast bonus episode for Give the Boys a Great Big Hand, the 11th book in the 87th Precinct series, which we did in our main episode, and we discussed such matters as the weather, the hilarious clothing choices of men in the 1960s in urban suburban, and tried very hard not to reveal the ending because it is good. So we'll do our usual thing of having a look at the different editions we've got. We've all got different editions today, so perhaps Morgan could outline his, because I think you've got the winner of good editions.
I'm pretty happy with mine. I've got the good old Green Spine Penguin Crime edition, £3.06. This is the 1965 edition, I think. So sadly not the TV Boardman one, which I think would have had a much more lurid cover.
But it's the first Penguin edition, isn't it?
First Penguin one, yeah, that's right. And it does have a rather nifty sort of photo collage.
Alan Spain,
indeed, yeah. With a great big hand, as one would imagine, with a little kind of rainy cityscape between this, in the space between finger and thumb.
Yes, great. I do like those photos. Yeah, there's something weird about that photo collage technique. It's almost like you look at that, you don't necessarily see that that's a hand to start with as well. Yeah. It just looks like a colour, and then you start to see it all come together. It's sort of rough and ready, but intriguing at the same time.
Yeah, it's a bit of classic sort of 60s Penguin design. It's really nice.
Yeah, definitely is. And it would have cost 3 and 6 in paperback. Okay. Oh, here's a point, before we get onto the other two books. The original TV Boardman edition of these books were hardback editions, the Bloodhound Mysteries, and they were 12 and 6. And I spoke to my dad, having been alive during the pre-decimalisation period. I asked him whether that was expensive, really. So in 1962, when the TV Boardman edition came out, it would have cost you 12 and 6. Oh. I asked my dad, I asked a couple of other folks as well, and they reckon that's probably what it was about for a hardback book. Oh. That's not an unusual, it's not super expensive, not super cheap. But actually, from what I gather, it's quite an expensive good. It's quite an expensive item to buy a hardback book because the paperbacks were, like we see here, like 2 and 6 and 3 and 6. So the difference between how much a paperback cost in the early 60s and how much a hardback cost was much more than the relative difference in the costs of them now.
Yeah. Still quite expensive hardbacks now, though,
are they?
But they're not like 10 times more expensive.
Twice as expensive, or three like times maybe. Yeah.
But so say a new hardback might be £16, maybe, and a paperback would be £8. So it seems like paperbacks were much more accessible and pocket money, not pocket money necessarily, but a lot easier to afford. And paperback and hardbacks were a bit more costly, which is funny because it's very hard to work out. The edition I've got is a Penguin edition, but it's from the 1970s. It's a reprint from 1977, and it costs 60p. Now, 60p is nothing nowadays, but it's very hard to understand, really, inflation in terms of not just doing the sums and going onto a website and saying how much is 60p then now, because it doesn't really tell you about the state of like inflation in big broad terms and stuff like that. But I suspect 60p was probably still quite cheap. But the edition I've got is the one with the precinct badge on it, my favourite. The cityscape in the background and the extremely literal hand in a bag. That's what it is. They didn't really overthink it, let's put it that way. What about you, Steve-O?
Mine's the quite new Orion. I remember I had quite a few of these. The 2004 Orion, which has a palm print of a very small hand on the cover, which is a bit strange.
What else is on the cover of that?
And then some, I think it's supposed to be the airline bag, but I don't know.
It's not much like an airline bag, does it, really?
It says, like a document holder,
which seems to have some hair in for some reason.
And some, like, plasters, I don't know.
Let's have a look. It's like got a case number on it, so it's
like a docket.
Oh, I know what it is. That is an evidence bag containing some of the black clothing that they have found in the book. But you would have to do what I just did, which was sit and work it out.
Yeah, it's a bit strange. Cover that.
It is. It's got that font on that they use on all the Orion books as well, which I have seen. In some of the new Doctor Who stuff, when that came back in 2005, I'm pretty sure they used that font for some things. But that's just me knowing those sorts of weird things. So you've got the newest edition. I've got the second oldest, and Morgan's got proper. Steve-O, you've got to give Morgan's edition a sniff. That looks like it'll smell gorgeous.
Yeah. I don't know. Remarkably odorless.
Not as musty as it could be.
No.
Oh, right. Well, that's a bit strange, isn't it?
Yeah. Slight odour.
Slight odour. I was trying to say something, then I couldn't think of anything.
I think also yours has obviously got the updated dedication.
It has,
so I think
yeah.
It's slightly different to the standard one that he put in all the rest of them.
So the dedication in the ones we've got, Morgan, I imagine, are to
Phyllis and Rick.
Good old Phyllis and Rick.
I tried to find out who they were, but it's quite hard to just look up Phyllis and Rick and hope that you're going to find something on the internet.
Phyllis and Rick.
So, yeah. Phyllis and Rick are either just
sitcom characters.
Yeah, they could be. It does sound like that. But they've left no internet trace.
Tragic.
Or none that I can find. I'd like to know who they were because it's just interesting. But there you go.
Just fills in a bit more of the background.
Yeah, the overlords have covered the tracks.
Definitely has been raised from time. So we had a couple of listener questions. One that pertains to the 87th Precinct in terms of what we're doing, which is from our friend Stella. Hello, Stella. Asking if anyone's made a timeline of the 87th Precinct. Because if you're doing a reread, you, as she says, you can see that the early books are only months or weeks apart, but obviously the things like having kids, Corella's kids, are only teenagers by the end in a series that's run from 56 to 2005. We've talked about it a little bit before, and she's saying, has anyone done a timeline? And I think people have, and I think there's some... You can, if you hunt deep enough on the internet, you'll find something.
I kind of started, but as yet incomplete.
I was
the yeah, because you can kind of chart.
Yeah, you can do it, and it can be done. And the only person I know that's done it in a published format is I've got a book in my hand, which is The Boys from Grover Avenue by George N. Dove, which does have a proper attempt at doing the timeline, although he has to make a chronology, that's a better way of describing it. He makes some changes around to try and get things to fit, I think. Suggests that certain books are before others. But the problem is, of course, that was published in 1982, so the series carried on until 2005. So it would be something I would like to put together at some point. And the thing is, though, it would require me reading ahead so much that it would drive me completely mad.
Perhaps we'll cobble together one towards the end of the... after we've done a sufficient number. Because at the moment, they're kind of just running on in almost real time, aren't they?
They are,
Because the frequency of these books kind of matches when they would have been. It's obviously when time starts to stretch into the 60s.
Like I said in the main episode, there's three books in the... published in the series in 1960 alone, but after that he starts to slow down a little bit.
So he's not kind of representing several different seasons of the same year necessarily, but...
Yeah. And then by the late 70s, the 80s, you're more or less getting one a year, aren't you? So, and, yeah, the time-stretching dilation thing in terms of human beings is just... You're never going to be able to reconcile it. You have to just live with that world.
It's like the Sherlock Holmes canon's like famously full of contradictions, and the only way you can make sense of trying to put them into some sort of chronological order is the fact that Dr. Watson must have been married twice.
Yes, you have to retrofit it, don't you?
Yeah, because it just doesn't work if you make the assumption. You're only ever told about one wife, but they just don't make any sense unless you accept he was married twice, which is a bit... mad.
It's amazing though, because obviously it matters so much to fans, but if you were as an author were trying to keep track of that, you'd just be spending all your time going, oh, but I can't do this, that and the other, and there's nothing worse than the idea of stifling your storytelling for the sake of saying, oh, but he was supposed to be in Peru in that year, whatever it is.
I haven't spotted really anything so far.
No, I don't think there's anything contradictory in the 87th Precinct timeline yet, anyway.
There may be the odd thing, and then obviously there are things that he has to update to make it just make sense to the reader reading whichever particular book it is, because...
Yeah.
You can't keep... When he's writing in the 80s, he's not going to keep referring back to people's military records in the Korean War necessarily.
Yeah, so he just shifts which war they fought in, doesn't
absolutely,
he?
Absolutely, yeah.
Like clever little things thing. Like that.
Because Lieutenant Burns is, you know, we hear about him as a young patrolman in some early books, and it actually gives you specific dates in the 20s or 30s or something. Yeah. So it can't possibly be, you know, the same guy. But of course it is, because it's the magic of literature.
Indeed.
Talking about magic, and it's a magical season, because we're recording this in December. This is our office Christmas party at the moment. We are covered in Christmas cake crumbs and full of pudding.
Absolutely.
But we have a question from a long-time listener and person who is just somewhere else in the same house as me at the moment, Lorraine, who wants to know, I can't wait to see your faces, if the 87th Precinct were to stage a version of A Christmas Carol, who would play whom?
If what?
So, Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, the classic Christmas story, if you had to transpose our characters into it, like the Muppets did, who would be who? See, that's it. It's a tricky question. It's almost nonsensical. Who would be the ghost of Christmas past, present and future? Who would be Tiny Tim? Who would be Bob Cratchit? Who would be Scrooge? Would Scrooge be Andy Parker and they're trying to...
Perhaps, yeah.
Yeah. I don't honestly.
Well, I'll tell you what, of course, he did do a Christmas book, an illustrated kids style one, didn't he?
He did,
of the 87th Precinct, which we're not going to get round to because canonically it doesn't turn up for another 25 years or something like that.
So
it might even be later than that. It might be in the 90s. Which
we'll get to it eventually.
Which might actually be the answer to this question.
Possibly. At the moment, I'm going to guess that maybe Birkling, due to his relatively young age, is going to be Tiny Tim.
Oh, bless his little blonde face.
Is Cruella going to be Bob Cratchit?
I would have thought so. I think the everyman in the story who's affected by the things going on around him. It's very difficult. I would like to know who would be the boy that Scrooge tells to go and buy a large turkey.
Oh, yeah.
Or is it a goose? I don't know, in the original Dickens.
I know it mainly from ridiculous adaptations. I've actually read Dickens either.
I think we'll stick with the Muppets Christmas Carol. That's the best one anyway. It's a very good one.
It is a good one, yeah.
Or Blackadder's Christmas Carol.
Well, which magnificent,
is absolutely excellent.
Yep.
Especially for Nicola Bryant, who plays his niece in it, with the most screeching, terrifying laugh. And I know that is because she's in Doctor Who.
Mm.
Or was in Doctor Who. And she's great. So, it's a very difficult question to answer.
We've cast a few roles there. Yeah. Right.
We'll do a, you know, we'll come across
one of the ghosts.
In the thousands of years it's going to take us to get through this series, it's inevitable that at one point we'll do a Christmas-based book, you know, where a crime takes place at Christmas, while we're recording at near Christmas time. So we'll go full Christmas then, I reckon. Anyway, as it's nearly Christmas, this is the present to... that I'm going to present. The present I'm going to present?
Is that what's in your box?
I've got locked in a mystical box next to me. It's something mystical. That I bought for myself, I must say. I couldn't resist this when I saw it on the shelves in a bookshop in Leek in Staffordshire. I say a bookshop, I mean a charity shop. It was 4 books for £1. I only bought this one book. I could not leave this book on the shelf.
Okay.
And when I present it to you, you'll see why. I'm going to pass it over, and I'd like Steve-O to perhaps describe it to the listeners.
Oh my lord! Wow!
This looks amazing.
This does look amazing. It's a book, and it's Roger Moore and the Crime Fighters, and there's a picture of Roger Moore, and then below it, I don't know, some children, a child being grappled, a child pointing to a policeman, and then a policeman with a sniper rifle. So, well...
The Siege by Malcolm Hulk.
Yeah,
Malcolm Hulk, I'll tell you about Malcolm Hulk.
Oh, we've got more on Malcolm Hulk.
Oh, that's yes, definitely.
All right, okay, so Roger, so there was three, with a further three in preparation.
Amazing. Illustrated by Ray Mutimer as well.
I don't know anything about Ray Mutimer.
Well,
some of the illustrations in this book. Basically, it's a paperback book. It's a children's book by the writer Malcolm Hulk, who's an author and writer of TV screenplays, TV stories, and it's
I'm just reading this. It's the siege, the African, the visa offer of the African Republic of Walinga.
It's a children's story that is, I don't want to say it's got dubious treatment of race in it. But basically, Roger Moore's name is on a series of books where a bunch of kids solve crimes, starting with this one that involves an African embassy, but also involves someone trying to disguise themselves by going to BBC TV to claim that they are being an extra in an episode of Doctor Who that's being filmed to try and infiltrate. I haven't read it yet, but I've put two little markers in there, Steve, so you might want to look at them. Roger Moore appears in this book as a character.
Cool.
As himself. Those two markers represent where Roger Moore first appears. And he's suspicious of stuff.
Can you help Mr. Moore? The heavy jowled man was saying. Roger Moore's casual jacket had a small herringbone pattern, the type that confuses a television camera's electronic eye. Well, there we go.
Hello.
I'm awfully sorry about this. I only just got off the plane. I had to rush here for an interview. Well, this does look good.
And what's even better is it's completely misprinted.
So
it ends on page 156.
Oh yeah.
But if
and then it goes back to 129.
My little tab in here, it's pages 129 to 156 are printed in the book twice, but there's no page 97 to 128.
Oh no.
So I've managed to buy a book from a charity shop that stars Roger Moore and a gang of children crime fighters. Or this is the book where they're put together as a team of crime fighters.
Wow.
That has been misprinted, but includes the sequence in the set in the BBC with Roger Moore printed twice.
Well, you know, it's the bit you're going to want to reread, isn't it? So.
Well, crikey.
What a terrific find. I mean,
the Walingan Embassy is the under siege.
It's terrifying in a way, because who would... Did this happen? Are there books by other people where they just... Other film and TV stars where they just appear in them as themselves? Who came up to him and went, Rog, I've got a proposition.
What year is this? 1977.
Well, I'll tell you about Malcolm Hulk, who wrote it. And one of the reasons I bought it, apart from the complete ludicrousness of it being a book about Roger Moore and some children fighting crime in an African embassy.
Same year as The Spy Who Loved Me.
The best Bond film.
Mm, indeed.
Malcolm Hulk, I know the name because he wrote for Doctor Who. So this book that has a sequence where someone tries to disguise themselves to get onto a taping of Doctor
Who.
That
would make sense.
Which would have been at a period when he was writing quite a few Doctor Who stories for John Pertwee. Or was probably when he was writing this anyway. He wrote some of the Target adaptations of his stories as well. He wrote for Patrick Troughton and John Pertwee. He wrote Invasion of the Dinosaurs, which famously has these terrible rubber dinosaurs attacking London, being brought there with a weird time machine.
Brilliant.
And he also wrote Frontier in Space, which is a six-part political epic, which runs into another Dalek story afterwards. Mm. And so I saw the name, I thought, I've seen that name before. And then The Siege, Malcolm Hulk. You turn the book to the front and there's Roger Moore looking out from a photo inset on the front cover.
Fantastic.
So if anyone knows anything about these books, then
great series.
Please
do a podcast about those.
Please let us know. And in fact, the Doctor Who references keep coming, because not only does someone try and sneak into the BBC pretending to be an extra on Doctor Who, one of the kids has a dog called Dalek. So there you go. That's my super treat.
It is a super treat. Well, and well done, and well done to the incredible Malcolm Hulk as well.
I wonder whether he was asked to do it or he originated the idea.
I'd like to imagine it's just it's something he was really passionate about.
Yeah, so I can write this story, but I can only write it if it's got Roger Moore in it. Not James Bond. No, not another spy character or a made-up actor. Roger Moore is essential to the plot of this.
Absolutely.
a man with North Sea hijack in his eyes.
Yeah. Are there any sequences where he arches an eyebrow? I certainly hope so.
I imagine
I'd like to have that described to me.
He is described as very handsome.
Well, naturally. And
they're not wrong.
Yeah, certainly not wrong.
I think I've lost...
Adolf Hitler gets a page on 88.
Roger Moore beats up Adolf Hitler.
It turns out he was alive all along. I brought him to my interview at the BBC.
The white man's mind is very strange. They believe all sorts of nonsense. Anyway, this helped Adolf Hitler 2,000 years later because the Jews weren't very popular.
I think Malcolm Hulks tried to incorporate quite a lot of political thought into this children's book.
In a less than sophisticated manner, by the sounds of things.
Yes, I think it may be a little clumsy to read these days.
In 1934, something wonderful happened for Hitler. A young Jew whose relatives had been put in prison in Germany went into the German embassy in Paris and shot dead a German diplomat. This gave Hitler the excuse he needed. The following night, his supporter turned up... Bloody hell.
doesn't say bloody hell in there. Roger Moore, turn to the camera.
Bloody hell.
What I'd like to do is to get our friend Rob Charnock to read an audiobook version of it and do Roger's voice because he's quite good at it, isn't he?
He is. Magnificent.
Yeah, that'd be a good just whole episode of the podcast instead of talking about...
I am going to... Well, you know I don't like to spoil books, but I'm going to read the end of the book, given that there's 35 missing pages out of it, but... After the rehearsal, everyone went to the television centre canteen to have tea before making the actual programme. Bonnie, Darren, Bill and all their parents pushed two tables together. To Bonnie's amazement, Roger Moore came over to speak to them. "Hello," he said pleasantly. "I'm Roger Moore." "I know," said Bonnie, her face burning. "You kids did pretty well," he said. "And Dalek," said Darren. Roger grinned. "Yes, and Dalek. So I've got an idea to form a club called the Crime Fighters for kids like you. Do you mind if I pull up a chair and tell you about it?"
So Roger Moore's forming
a gang so he can get kids together.
Amazing.
To send them out to do the work of the police.
Yeah.
One of whose face is burning and he doesn't even think to put it out.
Operation Yew Tree would probably be very interested in that book. If I might just send it to Scotland Yard.
Oh, Lord.
"This may assist you in your inquiries."
If you want to know where to find it, he's even put the address, because you can join the crime fighters yourself.
Oh, right.
Wow. You too can be a crime fighter, get a badge, a free newspaper, and a chance to meet Roger Moore.
Wow.
Join the Crime Fighters Club free by filling in the coupon and sending it to Crime Fighters Everest Books Limited, 4 Valentine Place, London, SE1. If you have borrowed this book from a library, copy the coupon onto a piece of paper.
Roger, tear it out. No one will ever know.
"Please enrol me as a member of the Crime Fighters Club and send me a parcel of goodies. I've got my parents' permission."
Cool.
I wonder if he ever did meet the crime fighters and how many people replied.
Yeah, I would think so.
I imagine there were legions of them.
Yeah. And that's why there was no crime in the UK between 1977 and the disbanding of the Crime Fighters Club.
Literally none. Did you ever see George Lazenby forming a crew of, like... crime fighters.
Timothy Dalton's traffic wardens. You know, like
marvelous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pierce Brosnan's lollipop ladies.
Pierce Brosnan's copyright theft investigation unit.
Yeah. Don't think so.
No. And Daniel Craig's done nothing.
Yeah.
Absolutely, he's not interested.
Daniel Craig's VAT evasion
unit.
Troop.
Oh, lordy B.
"Do you want to be a..." Fill in the coupon.
Customs. Send to Customs and Excise, Whitechapel. Oh, dear. Well, there you go. So that's... Of all of the strange little sideways leaps we've taken, I didn't expect that to be the one that I'd be talking to you about today. But I found this book, and I felt we needed to... Well, I needed to share it with you, my good friends, and I felt we needed to share it with the world.
I think it's worthy of discussion. And I'm glad that we've taken a look at that.
Okie doke, I think we'd better leave the listening public to more sensible things by saying goodbye like this. Goodbye like this.
Goodbye.
Goodbye like this.